You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hello and welcome for listening to yet another Dear Science podcast. I am Jonathan Golub, resident scientist at The Stranger, and this is Charles Medede, author of Police Beat, the column and the movie, as well as Zoo. Good morning, Charles. How are you?
How you do? Step up. There we are.
And we today are going to be talking about wireless electricity, which is one of my recent columns. So off you go, Charles. What do you think?
Well, I did read it a few days ago. So what I liked about it was the conclusion primarily, and I wanted to explore that conclusion. You know, most people have a fear of Oh my goodness, my memory is staggering. The relationship between cancer and electricity and comparing that to, say, the other real causes, which we don't seem to worry about, but to focus on, you know, on non-conductive electricity. Is that how you call it?
Yeah, or wireless
electricity. And so wireless electricity. And so I wanted to explore that. I mean, exactly. I mean, what that's what everybody wants to know, you know, is that, you know, is how there isn't that much science to there isn't what's the reality?
It's one of those things. I mean, there are a few things like this where it seems like there's a lot of I would say irrational fear over it. So we keep trying to study if, you know, living under high voltage power lines, which pump out all these radio waves, is it bad? Or living with a microwave in your house, is it bad? My parents had, when I was growing up, the first like microwave, and it was right after, you know, the meltdown of Three Mile Island.
Perfect.
This thing was like had like interlocks. It was like this little itty bitty chamber with like heavy steel and lead shielding, and it's sort of ridiculous because now everyone puts cell phones next to their head, which is microwave radiation, and it's essentially, you know, you get far bigger blast now than you did 20 years ago when these things came out. And I was thinking about this as well as I was writing the column. Why do people have this notion that wireless electricity or electromagnetic radiation is bad? And I think it's the terminology radiation is in there.
That's right, yeah.
And in truth, it is the same. It's the same stuff, just at a different energy level. It includes visible light all the way down to gamma radiation and X-rays, which are harmful, all the way up to radio waves and long waves that are effectively, you know, there's maybe a tiny bit of evidence saying yes, but then there's a bunch of evidence saying no. And my attitude when anything like this, when there's a fight, where there's some papers that say yes and some papers that say no, is my thinking is the one thing we do know is if there's an effect, it has to be tiny. Because if it was a big effect,
right.
You would immediately see it, and there would be no question. And then if you're kind of measuring, going around the margins, I don't think it's something worth worrying about given all of the other things. You know, for example, one I didn't even bring up in my column. Every deep-fried starch, anytime you fry starch, heat starch, anything like that, so French fries, potato chips, you know, corn dogs, anything like this, the starches get polymerized and end up making a horrible carcinogen called acrylamide, a neurotoxin, right? So you have, so you know, people, you know, worrying about, you know, their electric razor killing them and then eating French fries. And it's not to say that you're going to die immediately eating French fries from eating a little bit of acrylamide.
I would have died a long time ago.
Yeah. But it's you know, we're tougher than I think we give ourselves credit for. We're able to put up with a lot of abuse, and we abuse ourselves in far better ways than cell phones and microwaves and you know, wireless routers in our homes.
Well, we couldn't have survived this long without being somewhat tough.
Well, in another sense, that sort of irradiation that we're getting constantly pummeled by from the sun is an important part of us being here. You would never have gotten all of the variety of genes to select from without it. And so we actually do need to have a little bit of damage done. And there's other crazy things. Like a cross-country airline flight is about the equivalent radiation to a chest X-ray. So you can do this. I did this as a crazy person. I put a piece of photographic paper underneath me and sat very still for a flight and got a reasonable X-ray of my legs. And you know, it's hard to get the film gets fog going through the X-ray machine getting on the plane, but you can request them to do that aside and not, you know, don't put this through, it's just photographic paper. And did this before, you know, all the new security, but so we assault ourselves all the time, and it's sort of surreal to me that people get so worked up over this. And I think it's good to be cautious, and I think And these things were all found at the same time. That's the only other thing I can come up with, is that historically, so X-rays and radio waves were essentially discovered at the same time, historically. And so you have, you know, Marie Curie, who is dying of cancer from all the radiation that she worked with, these high-energy radiations. And you have people inventing wireless telegraphs more or less at the same time. And people may have just sort of connected that in their minds, and that sort of carried through culturally. Yeah. I don't know, though. I know.
Oh, yeah, but each new technology, inevitably, everybody feels that, particularly if it breaks the old world in a way. So meaning that if there's a sudden leap in how you experience time, mm-hmm. right, through a technology, there's always a concern that you've broken something sacred, like, you know, something that should not have been messed with. So suddenly if you put in, you know, this is classic. So if you put in, you know, a cup of water and suddenly it's hot in 30 seconds, I mean, that's going to cause some concern because it's so close to magic, right? The technology has made this absolute leap in reality that the first thing that strikes me, you can imagine the early people seeing this and having this problem when suddenly things happen that way, that it had to be incorporated somehow into the religious vision, into a religious explanation. So these, when you speak about that sort of thing, there isn't much science for it, and then there's this irrational behavior. It's the same as saying that, quite simply, that a similar rip in the culture would have caused changes, or at least responses that were equally as irrational within the religious system, right? You know, I mean, for example, you'd say, well, why were we defeated, right? Mm-hmm. Or we had a bigger army or something of that kind, where you don't understand what the impact of one group's change in how they shoot arrows or something like that. I mean, everything takes a while to absorb. But once it's done, I remember, you know this, mm-hmm. the microwave oven was actually called, you'd say the expression was, I'm going to nuke something.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It wasn't even, you know, I'm going to cook it.
This idea that they were related, this idea that you magically can heat water quickly by one way or another, it makes me very sad for the state of American education that microwaves are a mysterious, you know.
Oh, yes, I know.
A deadly thing, and it's... And I could see that, and maybe that goes back even to the historical relationship. Electricity itself has sort of had this weird relationship with humanity, going back to, like,
yes, that's true.
Before we controlled fire, right? I mean, that was it. You waited for lightning to strike, and then you ran to try to grab what you needed. And it was Benjamin Franklin who invented the lightning rod. I mean, before that, you would be in a building and during a thunderstorm, and suddenly there would be no roof. You know, and it was only after the discovery that you needed a pointed metal object to direct it. And I don't, but it is, I have a lot of trouble embracing the irrationality, because there's so many things that should be rationally concerned about that we aren't. And yeah, so many things that we should not be concerned about that we spend an inordinate amount of time. I mean,
but you can't, for the time being, it's hard to see exactly what the psychological benefits are, mm-hmm. for the irrational, you know, choices. I mean, right now you could see them as not having anything, you know, reasonable or anything beneficial, but it's hard to tell. It's hard to say what does this do for you as a person. I mean, not believing in microwaves, or being worried that there's going to be a generation of tumors coming our way through cell phones, right? Which is the idea. I mean, this is the belief that we're sitting on a land on a bomb, and that.
I mean, it would be intriguing if it was. I mean, in the same sense, I mean, maybe this goes back to the idea that the Roman Empire had its water supply by lead pipes, which were categorically, you know, slowly poisoning the brains and children of everyone in the empire. And now you have, like, and that our society is on a sort of a similar basis is ruining ourselves. And it's...
Yeah, that's a tough one. I understand the similarities, or at least the comparison, yeah. But it's still tough to say that. Nobody tested lead pipes.
No,
before,
I mean, that's the thing.
Before
we
using
tested,
them,
you know,
they just went ahead and drank. But there's another question here. So the big change now is dealing with which you point out that, you know, smoking was the first sort of achievement. Everybody agrees. No one's going to argue about smoking anymore. Mm-hmm. That's like a past. You know, that's like a past concern, right? Mm-hmm. So now the next one is going to be
trans fatty acids.
Acids, that's right. Is now the next? It seems to be the next.
And that's
terrain,
and that's an interesting one, because this is sort of the mirror image of it. It was something that was it's completely artificial. It's an engineered food. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fascinating. I wrote another column on this, but briefly, like the whole idea behind it is saturated fats, like in butter, like the really good solid fats at room temperature, are just long straight chains. So they pack in really nice tight together. And then the oils, the unsaturated fats, the natural ones, have sort of C-shaped bends in these long chains, and so they can't pack in well together. And that's why they stay liquid at room temperature, and that's why they don't make as good baked goods. So the brilliant idea back at the beginning of the 20th century was, well, let's just turn these C-shaped bends into more like S-bends, so that the chain goes, does a little jog, but then keeps going straight. So they'll nicely pack in tight together, and then we can feed people cotton, you know, cotton seed and other things that aren't exactly food products that we can make lots of money in, that we won't have to go to cows, and the world would be a wonderful place. And it was widely, I mean, really hit very broadly in the American, you know, the American and then later on the Western diet in the 80s, early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, replacing things like palm oil, mm-hmm. and eventually even beef tallow at McDonald's or in Oreos. And so you end up with it, everyone eating it, this completely new food that had never existed before. There really wasn't a tremendous amount of testing to show that it was safe. And, you know, then our livers see it, and they are not approving of this at all. And so that's why it's bad, is that it's not that, oh, you're eating a bad fat and that fat is doing bad things to you. It actually causes your liver to make more bad cholesterol, less good cholesterol, and it's the worst. It's the worst fat in all of them. You're better off eating sticks of butter, which raise bad cholesterol but also raise good cholesterol, and so it matches out. And that's something where it was not tested. It was an engineered scientifically engineered food product, and the science, the chemistry, and the science behind it is very, very clever, without a doubt. To take a cheap, abundant fat and turn it into one that looks or it acts like an expensive fat. And then you end up with people essentially becoming ill from it. And it brings all these interesting questions that it came in the diet about the same time as the obesity rate started to increase. And whether or not there's a connection is still a little bit tough to, you know, I don't think that's been demonstrated, whereas the health risks have. And that's an interesting thing, because, again, going back to this idea that, you know, a lot of people are concerned about wireless electricity or radio waves, and there's not a lot of basis for that. And then you have trans fats, which is sort of the mirror image. It's something that was sort of spread out without a lot of testing, and has now, after the fact, been found to have a lot of problem. Now we're laboriously trying to remove it. And then there's either cause for optimism that we can do that. You know, King County just voted to ban trans fats. That you can collectively sort of make a rational decision that we try something.
Oh, so we have done that.
Yeah. There was
sort of like New York City as well.
We are like, it's slowly being phased in. And packaged food doesn't fit the rule, but restaurants are supposed to convert over away from having trans fats. And I think this is a good thing. It's a little bit more expensive for the restaurants. You have to, you know.
Oh,
the good
yes.
thing about the trans fats also is even microbes won't eat them. They kind of spit up at it, so they last longer, and they don't go rancid as easily. and so, you know, maybe when mold is like, you know, we really shouldn't be eating this. We should have been concerned.
Whenever we try to move death out of something, it causes so much trouble. You know,
yes, it's like, just accept the food should be perishable.
Perishable. it needs death in it for it to work.
Something
well.
Else in the natural kingdom should be willing to eat it if we are going to be. But we, you know, I wonder if that's been tested here. So do people take longer to decay if you eat lots of Twinkies and other delightful foods?
Oh, yes, that's right.
I'm going to look that up and see if that that's true.
So, but that, I mean, so that's going to change. Basically, like in the 90s when they started, well, of course, the coastal states shifted and mm-hmm. started banning cigarettes in public areas, and so that's sort of basically going to happen again. So basically that's going to be bad for the rural, you know, I'm thinking political terms now, mm-hmm. saying that the blue states will thrive when they remove all this awful stuff out of their diet, and we can expect the red states to continue to decline in health,
but it's,
maybe, you know.
So if we stay on politics, which is probably a dangerous thing here, I would say that, you know, it'd be more like the blue states would continue subsidizing the long decline of the red states into
that's the sad part.
That's the
we
sad
will be,
part.
Because we're willing to be taxed and they're not. And so that's another issue.
They drag themselves to the 65-year-old finish line.
Yes, I know. We have to remove
the Medicare era.
Well, what we need is to require everybody to walk to a voting booth. That will totally cripple the red states.
Oh, wow.
You know, we will.
Hi, mom. Hi, dad. In the Midwest, We appreciate you voting.
That'll be the end, yes, of the red state political power. Not even half a mile. I'm talking just, you know, a couple of, you know.
From the long end of the Walmart parking lot to the voting booth.
That's all we need. You know, or at least a distance between the car and the voting booth. And we effectively shut them out, you know. They have to switch. Only those who can afford those scooters or whatever those things are.
The Segways, yeah.
Segways. Not even those.
This would be like a new poll tax, except athletic, and it's a sort of sense of officiousness here. So we should probably move on.
Okay, so that's it. You know, that was the main. I thought that was really the really important message in the column in the issue of like what we decide to fear and what we do not fear as being completely absurd, and that sort of covered my area.
I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, to my mind, this is the difference between being fear and respect. Fear seems somewhat inherently irrational. That as a sort of state, whereas having respect or concern or sort of that's more of a way of sort of actually ascertaining if this is something for which needs to be changed or it doesn't. And it's interesting, you know, and the other legacy that I think electricity and all of this field has to deal with is way back when everything was being electrified.
That's
and this
right.
big titanic battle between yeah. Edison and Westinghouse and Tesla, and these three going together where they, you know, Edison in the battle, so I should probably go back and actually describe what this was. So the initial power systems, and this is mostly centered in New York City, were direct current. And it doesn't work as well. It only can be transmit for about a square mile. And so it was sort of clunky, but it worked. It absolutely worked. And so Edison, being already concerned about the safety of it, decided to bury the wires underneath the road and didn't quite work right. The insulation didn't quite work right. Ended up electrifying horses and people, touching lampposts.
Wonderful.
It's sort of a brilliant vision.
I like the actual shock.
Yeah.
Being corresponding with cultural shock.
There's a story with this that a horse salesman seeing the horses jump over it, asked Edison to electrify his paddy to make old horses seem more lively by being able to jolt them into life. And so you have Tesla, who is an employee of Edison, a couple years younger. So you have Edison, who is like a brilliant scientist, but more on like the really hardworking guy. You know, the joke is, you know, if you wanted to find a needle in a haystack, you'd start with one piece of straw and then go one by one until he found it. He was not a big abstract thinker, hated math, hated plans, basically wanted to hold something three dimensions of a very tangible idea. And direct current is very suitable to that. Whereas alternating current is a bizarre sort of thing to try to break down into a metaphor where the current is basically sliding backwards and forwards and changing, which is very, it allows really powerful abilities. You can change the voltage of the current very easily. So the example would be when you think about electricity, you can think about it like a waterfall. So the voltage is how high the waterfall is, and the current is how much water is going over the waterfall. So if you think about how much power is coming down at the bottom of the waterfall, it's a combination of how much is coming over the lip and how high it's falling. So you can have a little stream falling a big, big distance, or a really broad stream falling a small distance, and it's the same amount of power. And a direct current, you get to pick one. And you have to stick with it. And you can't go too high in voltage, too high up, and have the waterfall be too high or it causes problems. But if the waterfall isn't very high, the power doesn't travel very long distances because you have to have a big, broad current for it. Alternating current, you can quickly jump. You can change the height of the waterfall very easily by going through this jump bouncing back and forth between electricity and magnetism. It's a change in current, which creates a magnetic field, which then can be changed back into an electrical current. And so that's transformers. That's what you see up in all the telephone poles, and that's how we power our society. We live in an alternating current society, which is that friendly hum you hear when you're in your headphones and you get too close to an electrical outlet. So Tesla was the brilliant man. He was a brilliant man, totally crazy, totally obsessive compulsive, not, you know, but brilliant. Almost the mere image of Edison, in the sense that he wanted to, like, he always said, you know, cut out 90% of the work by thinking, and then sort through. And so he was very hardworking, but brilliant man. And Westinghouse was sort of the real victor in all of this. He wasn't the hardest working, and he wasn't the most brilliant, but he was the most interested in the talents and abilities of other people in this little mixture. And so he ended up winning the battle and ended up essentially when his idea of having this alternating current based wiring system did it. But Edison didn't go down on the fight easy, so he was trying to show the dangers of alternating current by electrifying first animals, and then that didn't have the appropriate shocking, you know, scare people away from it. He invented the electric chair and had it as the first execution to demonstrate the perils of alternating current, and had not quite done the calculations right, again, not being a mathematician, and ended up essentially cooking the guy for an extended period of time rather than swiftly and efficiently killing him. So it's sort of this horrifying, disgusting story, and I highly recommend anyone reading a book. There's a nice simple book, AC/DC, that just came out by, I forgot the author's name, but you can pick it up at the library. It's amazing. You can zip through it really quickly, and it's definitely a titanic battle between real geniuses here. But I love the idea that it was the man who was most interested in the talents of others that seemed to really succeed at the end of the day and win it over.
You know, it's so strange. We have nightmarish images, you know, which we bring from childhood. One of mine is watching Thomas Edison, I think he was involved in this, executing or electrocuting an elephant.
Yes, that was...
It's such a terrible thing. And it falls, you know. It just locked up and smoke out of its ears and fell over. And it seems so bizarre. But,
you know. So it worked on you, posthumously. You're convinced against alternating current now, the electrified elephant.
I know. Yeah, it was too late for him. It was just 100 years too late. You know, but there's a. I'm also interested in another thing, you're speaking about the electrification of, you know, the race for, you know, what, how we're going to electrify society. There's also, to me, I always think that there's three really important periods in modern history, or at least recent history. Modern history would start way, way, way too over. When you say modern, you go all the way back to the 16th century. But if you say, recent mm-hmm. history. So let's say roughly like around the 19th century. I always think that the mid part of the 19th century is interesting, particularly in Britain, because of what steam engine does to the entire society, right? Railroads mm-hmm. and all this stuff. And the industrial discipline and all this stuff kicks in. Another period for me, and a lot of people don't know this, but the boom in the 20s is connected directly with electrification mm-hmm. of the United States of America. So that whole jazz age is also the electrification of the United States of America. So all this, not only does it just electrify a large portion of the society, which wasn't almost 10 years before. I mean, you know, it's just small pockets that where electricity was used, and suddenly this incredible explosion of the technology. And not just that, but the transformation, the introduction of other technologies. I mean, literally mm-hmm. Washing machines, refrigeration, the domestication the arrival of small domestic products, right?
Yeah, the appliances.
Appliances is born in that period, and that's connected with the stock boom and whatever you want to say about the crash. I don't believe the crash is connected to something else. And then, of course, the next period where this sort of happens is the 90s. So everything that if you lived now, you actually witnessed one of these, I think, crucial, like 1850s, the 1920s, and 1990s are all similar, because there's this rapid, first of all, economic growth as a direct consequence of a leading technology. Be it the internet. It wasn't mm-hmm. the computer. The computer was around the 90s, and it was felt, but nothing completely transformed, and was connected with an actual economic tremendous boom. And
well, in some ways, you know, we're starting to suffer, but globally, I think it's changed the face of economics for the world a way, and in a way that's really, it's one of those rare technologies that seems to have benefited the at least not in the bottom third, but the bottom half the bottom half of the world has at least had an opportunity here that never would have occurred before.
You know, this is Gertrude Stein said something similar, but I'm going to use it here because we went through the 90s, and because we were sort of in connected and became computerized, literally. I mean, that's what we are now. Mm-hmm. Before anybody else, at an explosive rate. I mean, the numbers in the United States of America of those with personal computers and connected to the web were by far ahead of everybody else, and the world is now catching up. The numbers are now beginning to balance off, particularly industrial societies and stuff and so on, and also in the third world. And in fact, the whole notion of industrial societies and and agrarian societies, or third world and first world, are now overlapped so that you can have them existing simultaneously. They're not geographic anymore. But that thing, I always say, because America went through it first, we are the oldest country in the world. We're totally old. We've already been through it. We're after the fact.
Old hands on it.
Right. We're senescent when it comes to this business of buying online and sending letters online and so on and so on. And I can say that's, I can sort of believe that, because I said, if you saw the '90s, you saw something that someone saw in the '20s and also in the 1850s.
So with that, we appreciate you using the internet to download this podcast. Welcoming you to the new era in the oldest country on the planet. I'm Jonathan Golub. This is Charles Mudede. Thank you very much, and thank you for listening. If you have a scientific question, feel free to write it to me at dearscience@thestranger.com, and you can download this podcast every week at www.thestranger.com.